From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Roderick, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking for May 21st, 2019. When you've devoted 46 years to teaching political science, and a good part of that time to being a pundit, you get to have an exit interview when retirement grows nigh. This spring's semester at McDaniel College in Westminster was Herb Smith's last as a professor of political science. Herb Smith started teaching American politics when Richard Nixon was still in the White House, and McDaniel was known as Western Maryland College. Over the years, Herb Smith served as faculty advisor to both the McDaniel Democrats and Young Republicans. Off campus, he worked as a pollster and Democratic strategist. Listeners of Baltimore radio stations and viewers of Baltimore television stations heard him over the years commenting on Maryland and national politics. He was a frequent guest on radio shows that I hosted on WBAL-AM and WYPR-FM, and on the ABC TV affiliate in Baltimore, WMAR. Herb Smith was a regular go-to pundit for Maryland reporters, and his keenest skill was bringing historical perspective and some much-needed humor to current affairs. He and former State Secretary of State John Willis literally wrote the book on Maryland politics, published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2012. It was entitled Maryland Politics and Government, Democratic Dominance. Despite his Pennsylvania roots, Herb Smith has been a student of Maryland politics and government since the early 1970s, when he lived in Baltimore and worked in the first mayoral campaign of William Donald Schaefer. Herb Smith gave his last and lasting lecture at McDaniel earlier this month. Before he left for retirement to his favorite fishing waters off Florida, I thought we'd spend a few minutes listening to Herb Smith reflect on American politics from the time of Eisenhower to the present. I'm curious, what was your first experience in politics? What got you interested in it?
It goes back, I think, to eighth grade, Haverford Junior High School in Delaware County, Pennsylvania. It was the 1960 presidential, and they decided to have a presidential debate in front of the entire junior high school with Kennedy and Nixon surrogates. Not going to tell you which side I was on.
Oh, please tell us. I can't imagine you as Nixon, but did you take Nixon?
I was a Republican back then.
Really?
And actually volunteered in the Nixon campaign. I have a host
Herb,
of
this is
of
something
Nixon.
I never knew. I'm so glad I asked this question now.
I rarely reveal this, but I debated my good friend, Stephen Wagner, who is now up at Harvard, and I've asked him to forgive me many a time because I won the mock election. Nixon won the mock election, like, by 690 votes to 340, which gives you some idea of the partisan distribution in Delaware,
Haverford, yeah.
In Delaware County, yeah. Pennsylvania at the time.
Is Delaware County where, many years later, after Barack Obama's election as president, a woman stood up at a town hall and said, "I want my country back"?
Actually, that was Newcastle, Delaware.
Okay.
Because I've shown that video to some of my classes on occasion.
Okay, I wasn't that far off.
No, you were in the tri-state area.
I can imagine. Do you remember what you argued in favor of a vote for Nixon?
Oh, there was something about Quemoy and Matsu, which were two islands off the coast of China, and the necessity of defending them against the godless Chinese communist hordes, that sort of thing.
Wow. And what was your opponent like, the surrogate for John F. Kennedy?
He was fact-based. I was totally into fear and emotion. I had my Republican chops down pretty well even back then.
Interesting. So you made a transition to Democrats?
Yeah, I think it was the Vietnam War that did it. And by 67, 68, I was enamored with I should note that even in 1960, there was something about JFK that I liked, and I was a little torn because I'm a lapsed Catholic, and he was the first Roman Catholic presidential candidate and then president. And I started drifting away, I believe. Barry Goldwater in 64 was, I think, a bridge too far for my Republican sensitivities. And by 68, I was a firm Democrat of the Gene McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy side of the party, the anti-war side. I was fairly active in the anti-war movement in southeast Pennsylvania.
It's a bit of history, but it is interesting to remember that the Vietnam War started under Democrats. If you go way back to Eisenhower, I guess you could argue it started under a Republican, but it really was the Democrats who ramped it up. And then Nixon promised to end it.
I have a plan to end the war.
Yeah, but the war went on.
Which was massive escalation
in
terms of the air war and the destruction of Cambodia, which, fantastic book called Sideshow, but, probably a... 500,000 deaths due to B-52 bombings of the Ho Chi Minh Trail there and the destabilization of the Sihanouk, Prince Sihanouk's neutral regime, and led to the rise of the Pathet Lao and the killing fields and all the nightmares that transpired after that.
I don't have it in front of me now, but I remember looking up just U.S. casualties in Vietnam and the time frame for that. And while there were a lot before 1968, there were many more in 69, 70, even 71, 72 started to decline. But still, Nixon had this plan, and the war went on. So if you were a leaning Democrat anyway, that would probably would have secured you for a while.
I mean, that was I think the enduring shame of Richard Nixon. He could have ended that war the first day of his presidency. He really could have. He knew it was a losing proposition. It was just a matter of his policy was Vietnamization, of replacing U.S. troops with South Vietnamese troops. But he could have just basically pulled us out. He had a very real talent for real politic. Henry Kissinger was advising him. There was no need to, essentially bolster our international image. It was a losing hand, and he could have saved 20,000 American lives easily and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese and Cambodian lives, and he chose not to.
In terms of your own personal views of government, American politics, what would you say you came away with after Vietnam? Because a lot of people became completely disillusioned with the government, the elite running our country, the military.
Well, this is something I've been thinking about quite a bit in the last few months, my final semester at McDaniel, my 45th year of teaching there. And that is, I'm a baby boomer, in the first cusp of the baby boom, 1946, which interestingly enough, we have three presidents born in that year, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and now Donald Trump, who was born one day after me, so we don't share birthdays.
And that's considered the first year of the baby boom.
And that's the first year of the baby boom.
Yeah.
We grew up in the 1950s. My father had served in the Coast Guard during World War II, and there was a feeling that we were the universal good guys, and politics was far more sedate under President Eisenhower. There was bipartisanship was cherished. Honest compromise was the means of arriving at solutions that might not have been perfect, but were agreeable to those on both sides of the aisle. And how distant those days seem today. What a wrenching transformation, not for the better, that we have seen. One other interesting thing we shouldn't forget, the highest marginal income tax rate in the 1950s was 90% on incomes of over $200,000.
You tell that to people today and they say, that's impossible, but it was.
Well, it helped promote a massive middle class. The United States was a middle class nation. Surveys at that time indicated 80 to 85% of adult Americans considered themselves to be members of the middle class. And while one could criticize perhaps the conformity of the 1950s, the quality of American life, and one should note, predominantly white,
yes.
was quite pleasant, that a family could have one breadwinner, one or two cars in the garage, annual vacations, a nice home in suburbia. Now, obviously, there were many folks left behind, particularly African Americans, other minorities. But we've always been a work in progress. Unfortunately, we've made improvements in many areas, but we seem to forget the possibility that you can have a massive sharing of the American dream. When Donald Trump in 2016 said the American dream is dead, it was absolutely true. The middle class has been shedding hundreds of thousands of people every year. Wages are stagnant and haven't really increased meaningfully since the 1970s. The Gini coefficient, which measures inequality of income in societies, puts the United States as the lowest Western developed nation in terms of highest degree of inequality. We're on a par with Russia and China.
When you talk to college kids today, I don't know if you get into conversations with McDaniel students about their ambitions after college, after graduation. I just wonder what you hear and whether you can compare that to how you felt coming out of college, your generation, or back in the 60s and 70s. I don't know, there seemed to be more promise that you would live better than your parents, for one thing.
You know, that was very much a given. You know, my parents had lived through the Great Depression and World War II. I recall my mother always telling me, you know, when you get a job, you always hold on to that job, because although she worked during the 1930s, she took a one-third pay cut as a legal secretary, but she retained her position. We had
the expectations
that absolutely that we would find an economic station that would be superior to our parents, that we'd have a higher quality of life. Today, I've found college students are very realistic. They understand that graduating from college in 2019 is basically the equivalent of graduating from high school in 1950 or 1955. About 80 to 85% of our graduates, you know, within 5 years have gone on to graduate school or professional school. That it's a world that's increasingly credential-oriented and highly competitive.
And also, you see in polls where there just isn't the expectation that we're going to live better than our parents have, that it's going to be tougher for us.
And this I regard as highly troubling, because there's been a withdrawal from the idea that government can be for the people, that government can solve problems. You know, certainly Franklin Roosevelt proved that in the 1930s and in the 1940s. Harry Truman, you know, created the architecture that eventually helped us win the Cold War, if we really want it. That's a question for another day. And even Richard Nixon, you know, certainly to give him some due, with the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, the passage of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. You know, you remember what the Potomac was like in Washington.
And mm-hmm. Or the Charles River in Boston, another one.
And Charles down by the river.
Yeah.
Love that dirty water.
Dirty water.
Yeah.
Yeah, those were good things. My earlier question was, coming out of Vietnam, why everyone wasn't completely disillusioned with government and Washington power is sort of miraculous. I think people realized you're not going to have a country unless you can affirm the Constitution. And when we got to Watergate, I think in a way Watergate was kind of a watershed.
Well,
it kind of helped.
Johnson and Nixon were two very severe body blows to the Republic. These were presidents that were deeply troubled. James David Barber, late of Duke, his presidential character, called them active negative presidents who, you know, while they certainly take to power, they will eventually abuse it. He predicted Nixon's failure, you know, before it happened. Mm-hmm. And indeed it did. You know, Johnson with Vietnam, Nixon with Watergate.
There was something good about Watergate. Don't you think? I mean, people seem to think of it as a black eye on the Republic, and I thought, No, the system works.
It showed the it showed
Supreme
the
Court
system
said,
could work.
You have to give up the tapes. The House Judiciary Committee voted to impeach you.
And again, this was, I mean, the House Judiciary Committee, the fact that a significant number of Republicans defected, including Larry Hogan Sr., who was a congressman from Prince George's County, demonstrated kind of a throwback to the bipartisanship of the 1950s. But then you had Ronald Reagan cementing this government's not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And, you know, the rise of a fundamentalist right wing that demonizes the opposition and makes it almost impossible for bipartisan solutions.
Herb came on my radio show at WBAL Radio on a Saturday morning sometime in the 90s after Bill Clinton had been elected, maybe a year or so after his presidency had commenced. And you had with you a copy of the Washington Post, a poll. And I don't know that pollsters ever asked this question before or put the word hate into a poll question about a president. But I'll never forget you saying and pointing out to me that day that 20% of the people in this poll said they hated Bill Clinton, hated the Clintons. I think Hillary was included in the question. And I remember us ruminating on hate when a political view of somebody goes to that level, right? And fully 20% of people said, wait a minute, how did we get here? I understand disagreement. We understand, you know, you're not going to vote for this person. I guess people hated Richard Nixon because of the Vietnam War, but there was nothing like that at the time. What brought all that on? I don't know if you remember this or not, but
I vaguely remember
it. It was an eye-opener.
Glad I had that kind of
to where we were going.
Indeed. Multiple thoughts on that. First, demonizing the opposition, pretty American. Our politics has always been a kind of blood sport. Goes back to, you know, the late 18th century. You know, Jefferson and Hamilton did not, you know, have nice words for one another.
Right.
And certain Abraham Lincoln was...
It was over political disagreement. And it was certainly a civil war. I mean, that was a bloodbath, literally, right? But we get to the 1990s and Bill Clinton's election.
Right.
What's all that about?
What was there to hate about Clinton? What was there to hate about Ross Perot? What was there to hate about George Herbert Walker Bush?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, they were conventional politicians. You know, if I had to blame anyone, I'd blame Newt Gingrich for much of this, which... I always think it's an object lesson in what happens when a professor doesn't get tenure, and he didn't, and, you know, started running for Congress in Cobb County, Georgia, and eventually won after two or three failed attempts. But he hit upon the strategy of demonizing your opponent, which perhaps he was a student of American history, and had a lexicon of words of weasel and corrupt and cruel and that sort of thing that he advised his fellow Republicans to use out on the campaign trail.
Let me add a couple of things to this timeline that we're on. Rush Limbaugh, late 1980s,
right,
early 90s,
right,
gets a huge microphone in the United States, far surpassing anybody from the left on AM radio all across the land. And then by 1996, push it up a few more years, you get the advent of Fox News. So now we're off and running where the media is taking part in this.
Well, the question, of course, had Fox News existed in 72, 73, 74, would Richard Nixon have resigned from the presidency?
That's an interesting question.
I think that's an open question right now.
Yeah.
Nixon's poll ratings on his resignation, he was about at 23-24% approval, which was about where George W. Bush was in 2008 at the onset of the Great Recession. Trump, of course, has a long way to go to that. Last poll I saw, though, his favorability was just 37%.
Yeah, that's after the Mueller report.
I think there's a hardcore base that's probably not going to bring that anywhere close to 30%, which I think is when many congressional Republicans would start questioning their allegiance.
Key word there is hardcore. Yes. This is a hardcore base. I know we talked our way through it on WYPR and then in this podcast when Trump emerged from all those Republican candidates and got the nomination and then shocked everybody by winning the presidency. And I just wondered, I wanted to get your reflections on who this guy is, this mess that we're in the last 2 years, 2.5 years now.
Well, he was the TV celebrity at the right time in the right place. So it's often been said we're a TV nation with a celebrity culture, and he fit the bill. If it wasn't for that, the show The Apprentice, which I probably watched for 3 or 4 nanoseconds during its 14-year run.
Same here.
We wouldn't be talking about a President Donald Trump. It really made him from essentially a obnoxious tycoon. To
kind of a New York City joke, really.
And he was very much of a joke in the famous Spy magazine characterization that he was a short-fingered vulgarian. Mm-hmm. Seemed to be holding, but Mark Burnett, actually of English extraction, has a very keen sense of taking basically international shows, game shows, and converting them to American tastes. And this, The Apprentice was essentially a show that originated in England that he had watched. And they picked Donald Trump and basically embellished him.
As a businessman, you mean?
As a savvy businessman who had won the game and was a self-made billionaire. And through the magic of television, you know, created this political force. And Trump is savvy enough to, you know, have his own reality show. I mean, Trump has the experience of The Apprentice. He has the experience of the pro wrestling circuit in which he had some action. And kind of combines that into this bizarre reality show of political rallies that most of us thought were long extinct in American politics.
Yeah, and he pushed the right buttons. Or he figured out, I'll try pushing this and I'll push that and see which works. And the one that works, I'll keep pushing.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what I think he learned.
He can gauge an audience.
Race. It's with us in almost everything that we discuss and are conscious of. And with Trump, even more pronounced, and people think we've taken many steps backwards on race.
I recall back in 2008 when we were at YPR and just kind of talking about, we're now in, after Barack Obama had been elected president, we're now in post-racial America, and that Will Smith was the number one star.
Yes, in the movies, in the box office.
Right.
Yeah.
And that we had, you know, we
crossed
a
line.
America had finally elevated its game.
Yeah.
We were sadly mistaken.
And look where we are now. So it's 2019. We have so many Democrats lining up to challenge Donald Trump to try to get this nomination. As we record this, Joe Biden has announced that he's getting into the race. One last time here, Herb, have you do some handicapping for us. What do you make of, what is Trump's vulnerability? Is he vulnerable? Do you think he couldn't be knocked off in a general election? And who would that be to do it?
Well, in my darkest moments, I wonder if we have an election, if the votes are accurately counted. I think anything is possible, and we need to be vigilant, and we need to be very responsible, and agencies must be responsible for a fair and free election. Because this, you know, we talk about every election being exceptionally important. This one is absolutely critical. President Trump is in trouble. I mean, his favorability, unfavorability is abysmal for seeking reelection. He has essentially one thing that he can claim, and that's a vibrant economy, but there are many holes in that. The income levels for easily half of American working families have remained relatively stagnant. His ballyhooed tax cut provided 83% of the benefit to the top 1%, and that's pretty widely known. And American corporations with profits of $2 billion a year, i.e. Amazon, have paid nothing in income taxes. This is not a rosy scenario for re-election. The fact that there are so many Democratic candidates, I think, is indicative of what's the perceived prospect of winning the White House. The national Democratic vote in 2018 was about 8.5 to 9 million more than cast for Republican congressional candidates. Now, understand, votes aren't counted that way, but it still means something important. There was a blue wave at the House level. And Democrats picked up 400 state legislative seats and a number of governorships. The U.S. Senate distribution picked up two Republicans, but it was a very pro-Republican schedule in the one-third of Senate seats that were up back in 2018. So looking into it, Biden and Bernie Sanders are the two front runners, but their support levels are only in the 20% level. I think most of the presidential wannabes, you know, think Vice President Biden is probably past his time to be a primetime player. Bernie Sanders is also rather old, with a message that has been heard before and is being parroted by a number of other younger, more vibrant, more dynamic, possibly even charismatic, time will tell on that, candidates. So it's wide open, and will be decided, you know, not by Iowa, not by New Hampshire, but those two races will provide, you know, much of the narrative. Folks will have to finish in the top three or four to be considered serious contenders. And you'll see a winnowing out of the field shortly thereafter.
What are your thoughts about the debate over impeachment? Post-Mueller report, we have Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, sort of holding her hands up saying, let's be careful about this.
He's not worth it.
Yeah, I mean, he's not worth putting the country through this.
He's not worth it.
But what do you say? What do you say about that?
It depends on what time of day it is. There are times when I'm certainly in agreement with Speaker Pelosi, whose instincts and political sagacity I trust to the utmost. She's a Baltimore girl.
Oh, she's really sharp.
She learned from her dad, Tommy D'Alessandro Sr., and certainly worked with
her brother. Actually, he was a junior.
Junior.
And her brother was the third.
Was the third.
Remember?
Young Tommy.
Young Tommy.
Yeah. There are other times when I think we should take Spike Lee's advice of do the right thing, and the right thing is impeachment. I regard people as educable, and Republican representatives, Republican senators, you know, when faced with the facts, you know, may well find the better angels of their nature.
It's possible. Even if they don't, the argument is, well, you've educated the public, like you say. There's been this process of impeachment. Now the public knows more about what was in the Mueller report. We know more about a lot of this, and now you can make up your mind in 2020, even if the Senate, which the Senate has never done, vote to remove the president.
Right. You know, Bill Clinton was impeached over lying about sex. What's happened in the White House in terms of the Mueller report is, you know, monumentally more serious and more significant than the Lewinsky affair.
One last question about college students. What do you hear from them about this election, about Trump? Are they energized? I mean, we're always looking to the next generation, you know, to pick up the slack, to make the most of some great awakening that we wait for here. But do you see that happening? Are they more active, this particular cohort you see coming up?
I think they will be.
This is Generation Z now, you know.
Yeah. Is it Generation
Z? It's Z, I think, that with this college graduation class, yeah.
They were certainly active in 2008. I mean, that election, I think, was the zenith of college activism in terms of my years at McDaniel. There are very few Trump supporters that I have witnessed, and they know that I advise both the college Democrats and the college Republicans, and I have a reputation for being fair and objective and fair and balanced, you decide. And I try to do that on every issue that we discuss. I think right now they're a little shell-shocked, but it could well change in the fall of 2020.
Well, Herb, I want to thank you for being my friend all these years, but also educating the audiences that I've been before in radio, on television, and in my column. You've been a great help to me over the years, understanding Maryland politics, bringing some really trenchant insight into national politics for me, and it's been a great pleasure to use you that way. I know you feel used, but that's what you're there for. You love this stuff, and you're a great political analyst.
I often, sometimes think, also back in eighth grade, I was having trouble in English class, and Ms. Weiser, the teacher, gave us an assignment to write a report on the Pennsylvania gubernatorial, and I got my first A, and I've been writing political analysis ever since.
That's interesting.
I'm a lousy poet. I'm not very good at writing fiction.
Yeah.
But when I talk about politics, it's right in my sweet spot. It's. I have a
similar story from eighth grade.
Really?
Yeah, I had to write an essay, and Bobby Kennedy had just been killed. Martin Luther King had been killed the month before.
In 68.
Yeah. So I wrote about that for an eighth grade class, and made the teacher cry. And that kind of shocked me.
Power of words.
Well, yeah. And I got an A on the paper, and here I am.
So pay attention in middle school, folks. Dan, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
I mean, the opportunity to talk to a wider audience than a classroom of 26 students.
Right.
And I'll always remember these days, the Baltimore Sun or YPR or WBAL, with great fondness as I retreat to my island stronghold in southwest Florida.
And we'll see you with a fishing rod, and I say, Herb Smith, tight lines.
Well, thank you, Dan. And thank you, folks, for listening.
Herbert Smith taught political science at McDaniel College in Westminster, Maryland for 46 years before his retirement at the end of this spring semester. McDaniel's 149th commencement takes place on Saturday. More than 600 master's and bachelor's degrees will be awarded during ceremonies in Gill Center. I'm Dan Rodericks for the Baltimore Sun. For my trusted and skilled producers, Steve Early and Hallie Miller, thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking and for supporting the Baltimore Sun.